project. I'll be talking to Mr. Robert Lovers, and we'll go ahead and start.
Okay.
Okay, why don't you just start by telling me what your life was like before the war started?
Well, we're Depression kids, our whole family. And I was a small town kid in Cedar Grove, Wisconsin. And I'm from a family of 8 children and mother and father. And so we had a big family, and we were Depression people. It was a bad time it was very bad for us. But it was good because the family was always together, and we grew up with a great deal of feeling for each other and all that sort of thing. My father would have been in World War I. I had an uncle who died in World War I. And I had 3 other uncles who were in World War I, but they never saw any actual combat. My father would have been drafted because he was the second oldest of the family, in my grandfather's family. But he had an accident in his hand, with his hand, and he lost his left hand, and he could not hold, he lost 3 fingers, so he couldn't, so they gave him a deferment, anyhow. So we lucked out in that sense. And Dad was a business person, but during the Depression, he lost his business and all that sort of thing. But it didn't make any difference to us. There were some very tough times, some very good times. We lived in a small town in Cedar Grove, grew up together, went to church together, went to school together. My grandparents had a farm near Cedar Grove. We spent a lot of time there. And then we moved to Sheboygan, Wisconsin, and that's where we all went to school. Brothers and sisters all went to Sheboygan North High School, and I'm the second youngest in the family of 8. It was a good time. There were a lot of good things. We played ball, we read, we studied. Mother was a wonderful person. She taught us poetry, she taught us music. And we had a great family time together. And it made me realize that there was something here. In retrospect, those were the good days. Those really were the good days, in spite of them being bad. Now what do you want me to do?
Now, when you enlisted, you said were you in high school still, or had you graduated?
No, I was in high school. I was on my way. I was a senior, and two other young men, two friends of mine, said, "Robert, what are you going to do about this?" And I said, "I'm not sure." I said, "I don't think I want to get drafted," because we had heard about Guadalcanal, and we had heard about Tarawa, and we heard about some of the battles in Europe, the bombing raids. You know, the war was already 4 years old. And our history class was very, very good about this. We had current event sessions, and the basketball coach was actually a reserve officer in the Navy, and he kept us up to date. But as time grew towards our graduation, my friends and I said, "What are we going to do?" Because I had a brother who was drafted, or two other brothers, excuse me, 3 other brothers were already drafted. My older brother was drafted in 1941, and my brother, second brother William, was drafted in 1942. And my brother Owen was drafted shortly thereafter. And mother was just, well, she couldn't do anything about it. But she never knew that I was going to enlist in the Navy. And I said, finally, after talking it over and thinking it over, I said, "I'm going to enlist." So the 3 of us took the train down to Milwaukee. enlisted, and I came back home that same day, and I put my enlistment papers on top of the piano, and I said, "Mother, I've enlisted in the Navy." And that was at dinner that night. That was evening of March 31st, 1944. Came home, had dinner, and I said, "Mother, I've enlisted in the Navy." She said, "What?" And I said, "Mother, I've enlisted in the Navy." And my father did not say anything. He was with me, I guess. And that was that. And so I finished high school, graduated, went to the usual graduation ceremonies. And then on June 14th of 1944, they sent me to boot camp at Great Lakes, Illinois. And that was the beginning of my Navy career. Wasn't anything very spectacular about it, but I just said, I'll be damned if I'm going to be drafted, really, when it came down to it. I was not going to get drafted. Because at least you had a choice. And actually, I enlisted at that time what they called the V-5 program. And that was actually for flight training for the Navy. But as it turned out, they already had enough pilots. They needed all sorts of ground people, ground personnel and whatnot. So eventually, many of us who were in that V-5 program were shunted into other aviation areas. I was assigned, after boot camp, I went to a place called Norman, Oklahoma. Had the best ride on a troop train in my life. The train was at least 20 cars long, and it was full of nothing but soldiers and sailors, and we were on a troop train. And every place it stopped, we got the royal treatment. It was gorgeous. That was one of the good memories of it all. But anyhow, we got to Norman, Oklahoma, and we went into what they call aviation ordnance school training. And I became, I was actually training to become a combat air crewman. At that time, the Navy had several airplanes. The TBM Avenger was one. The SPD Dauntless Dive Bomber was another. They needed combat air crewmen, machine gunners. And we would have been flying off of carriers and all that sort of thing. But even that changed. There was no longer a great need for those because the Navy really was pretty well, apparently, organized. And although down the road, the effort was going to be made to the invasion of Japan. And I was finally assigned to an air group, CB-54, and we were sent to a place called Narragansett Point, Rhode Island Naval Air Station, which was one hell of a place. Gorgeous. Wonderful place. And we worked on military aircraft. I was a aviation ordnanceman, second class, and I loaded and unloaded machine guns, cleaned them, prepared them, that sort of thing. The Navy had F-4Us, the fighter aircraft, the F-6F Hellcat, the Dauntless, the Avenger, and all those sort of things. We worked on all those aircraft, their guns, cleaned them, and helped conduct firing drills. What they did was we loaded up the aircraft and machine guns, and then they would take off and they would shoot at tow targets, and then they'd land and we'd check the tow target to see who had the most hits. What they did was they put red and yellow and blue and green paint on the slugs from the guns, and that's how they totaled up to see, you know, if these guys were any good. And that really was all that we really did. Serviced a lot of airplanes. But our group then was getting ready for carrier duty. We were assigned to a small aircraft base in the middle of Massachusetts, And that's where our intensive training began, night landings and that sort of thing, getting ready for the invasion. See, now this was in, see, the war ended in Europe in May of 1945. The war in Asia against Japan didn't end until August of 1945. So there was a time in there. As a matter of fact, I came home on leave when my older brother came home on leave May 8th, 1945. He was on his way to be sent to Tinian in the Pacific, and I was home on leave after. Before I was sent down to Narragansett Point. From training in Oklahoma, I was sent home on leave, and then I was rejoined by my unit at Narragansett Point. I'm getting ahead of myself here, I think, aren't you? Isn't that right? Or what else do you want to know about this?
No. Well, can I interrupt for just a second? I'm really sorry.
And thank
you. Okay, I'm going to go back to Pearl Harbor first, and then we'll move.
Sure.
But I just want to know, like, where were you at when Pearl Harbor was attacked? And I mean, how did you feel? What was your reaction?
Actually, I can go back further. My reaction to World War II goes back to a guy named Hans Kalten, born September 1st, 1939. We're glued to the radio. And Hans von Kaltenborn was a radio announcer on NBC, and he's the one that broadcast to the country that World War II began when Germany invaded Poland. And all we had at that time was radio, and we were glued to it. That's when my mother started to worry, because we're all growing up. And she knew it. This was 1939, and I was an eighth grader, and the following year I was a freshman in high school, 1940. And Pearl Harbor, December 7, 1941, we were actually visiting a cousin, listening to a Green Bay Packers football game on radio. And we were unaware. See, the time Pearl Harbor was 8 o'clock in the morning, which was in the afternoon in Wisconsin. There's a 7-hour time differential, and so we had gone to church, and we had been reading the newspaper and aware of some things, but not much. You know, there was not the instant coverage of news as there is today. But we did hear about the problems with the Japanese and the difficulties that we were having with the Japanese and the Roosevelt administration in trying to settle the differences about, the Japanese wanted oil and scrap from this country. And and there was an embargo, and but we had no idea that there would be any of this. So, as I say, we were listening to a football game at my cousin's, and had just finished dinner, and they broke into the game and said that Pearl Harbor had been attacked, and that was the first knowledge, awareness of that event to me and to us. And as I recall driving home from my cousin's place then, we didn't say much, because we really didn't know what it meant, other than the fact we barely knew Pearl Harbor. We barely knew anything about Hawaii. Hawaii was a place in the Pacific somewhere. We didn't know exactly what had transpired, what had happened. And actually, it took a while for us to find out. We got it on radio, of course, and the newspapers were full of it. I don't recall that newspaper edition But I do recall the headline that Pearl Harbor attack, a hit, something like that is what it was. And that was it. We went about our affairs because we were not immediately affected, other than the fact that we went to war. President Roosevelt, you know, Day of Infamy speech and all that sort of thing. But we didn't hear all that then. Just some of this, you know, is mixed up in hindsight and retrospect. But I do recall, though, the fact that that line did come into the newspaper story. And the declaration of war was made shortly thereafter. Congress voted on it, and that was that. But we went about our affairs, went to school, Dad went to work, Mom stayed home, did all the things, you know, and we just kept on wondering what was going to happen next. And things unfolded then as time went on. We were badly pushed around, of course, in the early part of the war. The Bataan Corregidor, Coral Sea, all those infamous battles were serious. We had read about Dunkirk and the British losing, you know, Europe and the Germans taking over all of Europe and all that sort of thing. Our history class was very good. But our experiences were distant. All we heard and knew was something that occurred somewhere else. Didn't affect us personally yet. None of it.
Well, then, what would you say was your overall perception of the war? I mean, as far as how did you feel about it, and even your attitude towards, let's say, Germany and Japan?
The perception of the war at that time, to me, was curious. I had acquired a better smattering of knowledge of World War I. And that was because when we were kids, we'd go to these Armistice Day and Memorial Day celebrations where these boys in their tin hats and their puttees and their khaki uniforms who served in World War I would go to the cemetery and fire a three-shot volley of salute to the war dead. And we kids then would hustle to try and get the cartridges after they were ejected by those 30-06 Springfield rifles. That was the only really thing I understood about war and soldiers, excepting my mother would talk about a family friend who was in combat in World War I and who was badly, badly shell-shocked. And he came home and was never the same person, she said. And I remember him, and he was a very gentle, quiet guy, but you could see something had happened to him. My perception of war was based upon that kind of romantic thing, and at the same time, the being unaware of what it could mean. Because combat, I was thinking about that today, combat is the most searing experience anyone can go through. My brother went through it. Two of my brothers were in combat. I had a cousin who was in combat, and I lost, that I know of today, two other friends who were lost in World War II. They went to combat. I did not. The perception then became one of, well, it's not going to affect me. I'm going to go about my studies and do what I think I have to do and all that sort of thing. But in the back of my mind, I suppose, lurking was this idea that how long was this going to continue, and as we grew older, it started to become more and more of an event that could not be ignored, could not be hidden, and had to be dealt with. And Mother did. And when my older brother was drafted in 1941, I remember we all went down to the train and said goodbye. Dad, Mother, all of us. Because he was my older brother. And I said to myself, where's he going and what's he going to do? Is he going to come back? Because he was drafted. And then that continued. My second brother, the second oldest brother, there are five brothers and three sisters in my family. And the birth order is arranged in such a way that I'm the second youngest. My brother is the second oldest to my oldest sister. And then there are two daughters, or two sisters rather, and then my two twin brothers were born. So they were about a year and 8 months between us. But after he graduated, that is my second oldest brother graduated from high school, he too was drafted. And he was sent down to a place in Arkansas to become trained in what they called a railway operating battalion. And I had no idea what that was all about, but that's where he went. And then after that, in 1943, my third brother was drafted, and he went in the Navy. Owen was drafted and was able to choose the Navy, and went sent to Great Lakes, and then the mother's flag in the window had four stars on it. Three stars. Because she started with one, and then two, then three, and she ended up with six. One of which was red because my brother, the second brother, was wounded very badly in the Battle of Leyte. And as I understand it, the two brothers ahead of me were in that same engagement, but they didn't know it. He was in the Navy as a signalman, and he and my brother William, that is, went ashore as part of the invasion troops on Leyte. And finally, my sister Marcia enlisted. She went... she enlisted because she thought it would be an interesting thing to do. And my youngest brother, or the brother behind me, also finally was drafted, and he's the only one that got to Japan. He was there as part of the occupation troops. And he came home in 1947 after being discharged. So we had a whole series from 1941 to 1947, when the military was a very, very important part of our lives, even though it was distant. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How did you feel as far as about Germany or Japan? I mean, because I know at the time there were some people that were very prejudiced. A lot of hate. I mean, was there?
In retrospect, there was, but not then. In fact, I did a paper for school about Japan because I had an interesting. For some reason, the Japanese lifestyle, so foreign to us, had a lot of things that seemed interesting to me personally, Why that should be, I don't know. But accepting that, I had a feeling that they could teach us something about somebody else. And as far as Germany was concerned, history said to me a lot about Germany. And so there may have been a built-in prejudice, but that came later, if there was one, and that came later if there was one from Japan. We lived in a city in Sheboygan which was heavily German in population, and it was always bruited about that there were Germans who supported Nazi Germany. It was said that some residents had pictures of Hitler and candles and the Nazi swastika and all that sort of thing on their walls or in their houses. Could have been. I have no idea. That's only a rumor. Not even that. It was just something that people wanted to say because what the Germans were doing at that time. They were sinking our ships. They were killing our soldiers and sailors. They were, our sailors at least. And they were bombing the heck out of Britain, and they were fighting the Russians, and they were killing people. And in my reading of history, though, I acquired then my feelings for Germany and for Japan. And in boot camp, they taught us how to hate Japan. They really did. They showed us what the things that the Japanese did in film. And so we were conditioned. To this day, I have trouble thinking about the Japanese red flag or red circle. Whenever I see it, I drift back into those days. And Japanese things are tough for me to take and accept still. And I found other veterans who feel the same way. But that's hindsight. Then it was not the case. And it was the curiosity about Japan to me still is, why did they do this? And why did they decide that if they were going to if they needed these things, why did they decide to attack the United States? They were actually winning the war in China. They had whatever they needed there. They had invaded. Of course, that was beginning of World War II for us. But they had invaded the Netherlands, East Indies for oil and so forth. But they really did not to my now way of thinking, they were very stupid to attack the United States. They really were. Because they didn't have to. Accepting that in retrospect, governments who are not democracies never understand really the value of depending upon the democratic will and deciding what to do and how to do it and when. Japan was at that time the most closed kind of autocracy run, as they said, like to say, by a group of fanatic warlords. And Hideki Tojo was principal prime mover of the whole Japanese attack, and when it was something that Japanese, I think, still realized that they made a big mistake eventually. And when Yamamoto said that they had made a great big mistake in attacking the United States, it turned out to be true. But what it did, though, was made the Japanese realize that there has to be some kind of a governing system that does not use war as an instrument of policy. again, that's history, in my mind, speaking. The Germans finally got it as well. They understood it. This morning on public radio, Garrison Keillor mentioned that, let's see, how was this? He talked about Armistice Day, and that Bertrand Russell said that he was talking about World War One. He said something like World War One was begun by a bunch of very, very spoiled rich people and rulers who went to war not for any reason other than because they felt slighted. And that's very, you know, if you go back into your history, the Germans and the Austrians were instrumental in beginning World War One, and that was the biggest mistake they ever made, because they no longer exist. But history is full of strange quirks like this, and it's extraordinarily fascinating because of it. The United States was probably guilty of something similar to what Germany did in World War II and World War I. The United States today is probably as guilty of being a heavy-handed in Iraq for the same reason. We were afraid of something, but we had no real reason to believe it, so we had a construct a reason to do it, and the WMDs, and that Saddam Hussein was going to attack the United States and all that sort of thing, as it now turns out, were all lies. The lies that Germany fought World War One and Two on are equally transparent. And the Japanese were almost the same in the same way. They did not understand that there was no need for them to go to war against the United States, but they built a whole structure of belief on the fact that they had to, and there was no reason to do that, none whatsoever. I as you can tell, I tend to roam away from questions, but it's
this is fascinating. I enjoy it.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that. Go ahead. Did I answer your question?
Yes. Yeah. I'm going to kind of stray a little bit now, and just I know we talked about where you went when you went to boot camp.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
As far as just if you could give me a sense, kind of what your everyday life was there. I mean, as far as you know,
in boot camp.
Yeah, I mean.
Up in the morning at six, and you had to be in the sack at 9 o'clock. And it was a routine. It was lots of drilling, lots of marching, lots of FIAD, physical training, because most of us high school kids were not in that great a shape, but they got us into shape. We had marksmanship. We had rifle range. Safety, water safety, swimming, some hand-to-hand stuff, that sort of thing. But lots of some studies. We learned about Japanese ships, and let's see, how can I put this? If you were assigned to a ship, and you're in the middle of the ocean, the only light you've got is the starlight. But strangely enough, silhouettes of ships are very visible. And so they would give us, put us into a room like this or larger and dark, and then they would have a screen, and then no lights, and this screen was very, very dim and very dark, and then they would show silhouettes of these ships, and you had to recognize them based upon their structure. The Japanese had ships that had interesting superstructures. They call them tower or pagoda superstructure ships. Some of their battleships were high, and it looked like they could keel over because of their center of gravity would be out of line. But that's what they did. They taught us airplanes, ships, and so forth, recognition, and that sort of thing. Boot camp was, excuse me, boot camp was a rewarding experience because we got to know each other. We got to learn to rely on each other. It didn't make any difference where we were from, but we finally became a group. And we were, I'm sure we were brainwashed, and I know we were brainwashed, because they told us about how bad the Japanese and Germans were. And they made certain that we saw various kinds of film that showed them, showed us how bad they were, what they did, that sort of thing. They wanted us to learn how to hate, is how I can only address that. But we had time for some other things. There was no boot camp, there was no leave until after boot camp. We could write letters, we had time off. I sang in the Great Lakes Choir, which had a big choir of all male voices, and we had a performance every Sunday. We had to sing. It was really quite something. And I learned, strangely enough, I got an appreciation for music from being in the Great Lakes Choir. It was a good experience. And but they trained us, they taught us, and they made certain that we were going to become good soldiers, as it were, in this case sailors, who believed in what we were doing. That's really what boot camp was all about. And it was a good time. It was a good experience. I didn't mind it one bit. Ultimately, I felt later on that what they were doing was probably could create some psychological problems for some people later on, but that's immaterial. They wanted us to become ready to fight if we had to. That's what boot camp was all about. And then leaving boot camp was an interesting experience. They put us what they call an outgoing unit area, and that's where we all got assignments. And we were shipped out from there to ships and to bases and whatever. And that's when I got my assignment to go to Oklahoma, board this troop train after my boot camp leave. When I got back to OGU, they put me on a train in Chicago, and we went ship. The train left. I forget when exactly, and we went down to Oklahoma to begin our combat aircrew training. And but as I say, that was a great, great trip. We'd stop several times because the train had in those days, of course, it was steam and coal. It had to load up with it, water and coal. And so we had stops for half an hour or so in various towns on the way. And they turned out like crazy. The women of those small towns gave us everything. Whatever we wanted, we'll get it for you. Here's sandwiches. Here's cake. Here's this. Here's that. What do you need? And they were gorgeous people. And I was in Hannibal, Missouri, and the train stopped there. And a very nice young woman she was wearing some kind of a pin and a little hat. She's very nice young woman. And I got off the train, and I was standing around and, you know, stretching my legs, and she came up to me and said, "Can I get you something?" And then she had this sandwiches and fruit and soft drinks and so forth. And she said, "What would you like?" And I said, "I need a sandwich," and I took some fruit. And she said, "Are you going, where are you going?" And I said, "I have no idea. I don't know where." And she said, are all of you going to the same place?" And I said, "I don't know. I have no idea." And she said, "Well, I hope you all come back." And that's all she said. And I wish I could, you know, I wonder whatever happened to her, because she was absolutely, she made me feel good at what we were doing, what we had to do, even though we didn't know, but she knew that we were going somewhere, and that we were doing something that she didn't or couldn't do and wouldn't do or didn't have to do, and we did. And so she reached over that wall to us, to me at least. And it's still one of the best memories I have of that little trip. It was a couple days, and it was good. She was a lovely young woman, and I hope that she had a good life, because she made me feel good. It was a good thing. One of the good things of that war was that, for me, was that little vignette.
Now, boot camp, you said you couldn't go on leave while you were at boot camp.
No.
Once you were stationed where you were stationed at, what did you do to entertain yourselves when you went on leave?
Well, in Oklahoma, there wasn't all that much to do, although a friend of mine, on Thanksgiving, that would have been in 1944, Thanksgiving, we got leave, and so we went to Oklahoma City. We were stationed at a place called Norman, Oklahoma. Norman, Oklahoma Naval Air Technical Training Center, Norman, Oklahoma. And it was a place for pilots and air crewmen and everything else conducted with training people how to fly airplanes and service them. And but that Thanksgiving, we got leave, or liberty is the Navy term. And so a friend of mine, a new friend, he was from Detroit, and I said, "Okay, we'll go to Oklahoma City and see what it's like." And we got off the bus, the military bus. That's what the military had, a bus that took us in. And took us, I'm not sure if, I think they dropped us off at the bus station. And we said, "Well, what are we going to do?" And we walked, and we were looking for a restaurant or something like that, because Navy Chow, you know, I can tell you a story about Navy Chow that'll curl your hair, but I won't go there. But we were hungry. And we went past this hotel, and a man got out of a car and said, "What are you boys doing for Thanksgiving?" And I said, "Well, we're looking for some place to eat. We're hungry. We want to get something to eat, and then we have to go back. We had the day, is what it was." He said, "Would you like to spend Thanksgiving with us?" And I said, "Well, sure." although I had no idea what to expect, but I said, well, thank you, yes, you would. So he took us to his house, and there he and his wife and, as I remember, one young child, we had Thanksgiving dinner together. And it was really, really very good. She cooked a wonderful Thanksgiving dinner. If I compared it to what we had back when we had Thanksgiving growing up in Wisconsin, it was very comparable, very good. And the man, I'm sorry, I don't remember his name or his wife's name. I don't remember. But they extended themselves to us, and it was a very nice thing to do. Other times on leave in or on liberty in Oklahoma, movies, and that's about it. Movies, or I think I went to the library a couple of times. I know I did, but I never really liked Oklahoma City that much. I never really did. I don't have much of a feeling for Oklahoma to this day.
Well, I'm going to kind of go back. You said the Navy chow was bad. It was pretty bad food.
Well, it could be bad, and it was awful sometimes. I remember one time I was at Narragansett Point Naval Air Station at this time, and I just come off watch, and we were walking past the chow line, or we were in the chow line, and we had to go past the galley, and the door was open. It was a hot, kind of a summery day, and hot, and they were going to have chicken stew. And I recall seeing these great big pots of bubbling away, you know, and there were chickens in there. But the bad thing was the fact that the chickens' feet were still sticking up, and I'll be damned if there was not chicken shit still on those on those feet. And I said, I don't know if I can eat this. That was one example. But you've heard, maybe you haven't, but SOS was another term for something that was, well, I'll tell you, it's going to be recorded, but I hope you edit it out of there, but it was called shit on the shingle, which was some kind of cheese sauce on toast for breakfast. With fried potatoes. I'm sorry, no, that didn't make it. That did not make it. Other days, we had a lot of mutton. And for some reason, I think the sheep farmers in the West out here got lucky because we had a lot of mutton. And sometimes mutton can be awful. It really can be bad. But we had stew and powdered eggs, a lot of those, lots of oatmeal, cereal in the morning, not much fruit. It was okay, but no. In those days, Navy chow was not all that good, but it was interesting. And there were times, some of the celebrations days were pretty good. They made a point of having good chow on some holidays. That's true. They really did. In fact, one Christmas, see, that would have been in 1945. I came home for Christmas in 1946 on leave. No, I didn't. I wanted to get home, but I couldn't. I asked for leave, and I couldn't get it. So I sent my mother coffee pot glass, wrapped up with tape and all that sort of thing in a box. And when it got home, it was all smashed, broken. And I sent my dad a carton of Camel cigarettes and a necktie for Christmas in 1945. And I was still then... That was 1945. 1946, I was in... 1946, I was in Ayer, Massachusetts, Naval Air Station. I didn't get home then either. So, but Christmas dinner in Ayer at that time was okay. It was good. We had good, they did well for a while. Thanksgiving dinner was okay. You know, celebrations, the Navy did it upright. But regularly, the chow was not that good.
Now, how were your relationships as far as with the other guys that were serving with you? And then was there a difference in your relationships with the guys that were with you versus your relationship with officers or...
I was an aviation ordnanceman, and I had assigned duties, and I was pretty good at it. I could take down a 50 caliber machine gun in about 30 seconds and clear the bolt and all that sort of stuff. And so I could do what I had to do, and I was good at it. They trained me well. I was good at it, and so forth. And I had that made a difference working with the rest of us in our unit. The Navy had a system. We were on 8 hours and off 8 hours. And then our unit was divided up into watches. And I was in the starboard watch at the time. And so... Sometimes the starboard watch would get night duty, sometimes day duty, and so forth, just depending upon how they wanted to, what they needed being to be done at the time. And so we had a very good unit. We were good with each other. When we were not doing something, when the aircraft were flying or something, or on a training mission, we had some time. So we would play cards and read and so forth. But we were on duty, but we had some time waiting for the plane to come back to be serviced again. And the relationship with the rest of the guys were good. I met some good friends, very good friends. I don't know what ever happened to them. After the war, we never really stayed in touch that much. When you're in combat, you develop a closer relationship with each other than you do when you're not, is how I look at this. And in some respects, I said to myself, you know, Robert, all you did was change clothes for 2 years. You put on a funny suit for 2 years and you came home. And that's really all it was, in some respects. It was an experience that taught me about relationships to other people, to doing something that I had not expected ever to do. A relationship with some kind of a... Something that was uncontrollable by me. And so, in effect, I made the best of it. What I had to do was do, and I did. And actually, I got along quite well with people who were with me. I didn't have any authority. As an aviation ordnance second class, that's two stripes on your sleeve. That's all it is. Doesn't mean anything. And but if you proficiency in how to do something very, very special that had to be done. But to this day, there's no need for that sort of thing. I mean, come on, what do you need a? What do you, you know? It's a great trick to tear down a 50 caliber machine gun and clear the bolt and so forth and get it ready to firing again in a very short time, which they timed us on, or to shoot the damn thing. You know, that's something. But it's a meaningless thing to be trained to do, excepting that it was very, very essential then. And so I put it in perspective, and it's fine. And I must admit, some officers were hard to deal with. Some young officers were, especially pilots. The pilots were under extreme stress and strain. Landing an aircraft in a confined area at night with only blue lights as delineating your landing strip at night is a trick. And you admire them for it, but that's what they had to do because the ship at that time was roughly 800 feet long. And that's not very long to put a plane coming down at night and making it stop in time so it doesn't go over the side. I mean, that was what their training was all about. So when they did that, you know, they were good. That too was a very special thing that actually, in a sense, to this day, there's no need for it, excepting that you had to do it then because we were all getting ready to do something big, and that was eventually to head to Japan and bomb the hell out of them and make them end the war and stop this nonsense. I mean, that, you know, they were talking about million American casualties in the invasion of Japan. Dead casualties. And the kamikaze, which everybody had heard about towards the end of the war, was going to be equally as bad then, because the invasion fleet would have been prime targets for the kamikaze attacks. And who knows? The American Navy suffered a huge number of damaged and sunk ships and casualties from those kamikaze attacks. Anybody who watched the pictures of those of a couple of carriers in the Battle of Okinawa coming back after being hit by a kamikaze knows that the Navy went through all kinds of hell trying to fight off the kamikaze attack. Well, that was going to be just a prelude to what we could expect in the invasion of Japan in the fall of 1946. That was going to be something, and I suggest anybody who wants to know what that was going to be like, there are some books out about that whole possibility. And when Harry Truman decided to drop the atomic bomb in 1945, in August of 1945, to end the war in Japan, in spite of the huge number of casualties the Japanese suffered at Nagasaki and Hiroshima, I still believe it was the right thing to do. Even though at that time the Japanese were wanted to surrender, but at that time, in case you want to check your history, but there was an attempted coup by the Japanese military to continue the war. Some younger officers tried to seize, at that time, which was the Japanese emperor's message of surrender, and prevent it from being broadcast to the Japanese people. Because the emperor at that time said, had agreed that it was no longer possible for the Japanese to carry on the war, much less win it. But there was an attempt, a coup d'etat, by some younger Japanese officers who believed yet that they could, with the kamikaze and all those things, that they could still carry on the war and possibly even win it. And Harry Truman I'm sure he knew some of this, but at that time intelligence was not that good or close. We didn't know what was really going on. And the A-bomb in Nagasaki and Hiroshima were the coup de grace for the Japanese, and they realized it, and it was really the final most important part, the final period for the war, to make us realize how bad this whole thing was, that this country was in many respects unaware of how can I say this? I shouldn't say unaware, but we were going through all kinds of particular hell at the time. The Navy and Okinawa was one of the bloodiest battles this country ever fought. We had gone through D-Day. We had knocked, Germany was out. But we had tremendous losses on a number of islands in the island campaign, beginning with Guadalcanal to Tarawa and Peleliu and Saipan and Guam and all those places. Iwo Jima, for crying out loud. You know, the huge number of losses that we went through to get to the point where we could do something about the Japanese was yet not completed, because there was going to be this invasion that MacArthur wanted to mount and was going to be needed unless we could stop it. And that's the reason why the bomb was dropped, because Harry Truman said, no more American casualties, no more unnecessary American casualties, among other things. It was a weapon. And weapons are used. That's what weapons are for. To kill the most people the most quickly as possible. Kill them. Get rid of it. Stop it. Because that's really what it is all about to me. War is absolutely the worst thing in the world for people to be engaged in. There's no need for it. That's why I say we shouldn't be in Iraq. We don't need to be there. We don't need to have American soldiers killed in Iraq. We don't need to be there. World War II was necessary, in a sense, because, one, we were attacked by two foreign countries. Actually, one foreign country and the other foreign country joined in. But it was something that we realized that if we're not careful, the whole world would engulf us. We would be faced with all kinds of problems that Britain had already been facing since 1939. So we had to do something. And so we finally realized that the idea of World War II was a just war, because Hitler was the worst kind of a despot, worst kind. And the Japanese weren't any better. All right, I've digressed again.
That's okay. I want to kind of get to where you were and how you felt E-Day came, and where you were and how you felt.
I was in VE Day. I was stationed in. Good Lord, Robert, you should remember this. I was on leave. I was stationed in Norman, Oklahoma, and I came home on leave because I was getting ready. I was on my way to a new assignment. After training, after spending, how many weeks was it? Let's see, I was in OGU in October. Let's see, June, July, August, September. Boot camp was 16 weeks. That would be June, July, August, September. Got leave in September, went home after boot camp, went back to OGU, shipped out to Oklahoma, came home on leave from Oklahoma, went back to Oklahoma, NATCC, took a train to Narragansett Point, so the Narragansett Naval Air Station. So I was home on leave, actually, when VE Day occurred. My brother, my older brother, who was had been in training as a crew chief for a B-24 in Texas, and I were home together. And VE Day was a relief. And at the same time, I wasn't free to go anywhere except and go back to my unit. And so the war wasn't over for me. But it was a relief that we had finally been able to get rid of the Germans and what they were doing. And how important that was to restore some kind of feeling of normalcy. But again, that's hindsight. Normalcy never occurred to me, other than the fact that, well, I've had some more responsibility. I was still in the Navy. I couldn't go anywhere except go back to my unit and report for a new assignment. But my brother and I were at home together, and mother and dad and my younger brother and my two sisters and so forth. We had a nice time. And that was that. I had, I think it was a 5-day leave, and then I had to get back. And my brother Arthur, oldest brother, had something similar, and he too went back. And then from there on in, he was sent to the Pacific. And to this day, I don't know. I don't ever know how he got there, or what kind of a ship he sailed on, or whatever. It's one of those questions I've often asked myself, and I wish I had been a little bit more circumspect. When we, after the war, we never talked about these things. No one ever did. We just said, "Well, we're home," and let's go at that. There was no reason. The friends who were in combat seldom talked about it. My brother, older brother, who was in combat, never, ever talked about his experiences after he died 4 years ago, August. We found out what he went through. And I've done some studying a little bit on his where his unit was and what he did and so forth. But he never talked about it. And my other brothers never talked about it. And I feel that's a gap. Because you're doing what we should have done, in a way. At the same time, many of the combat soldiers can't talk about it. And don't want to talk about it. And I'm sure you know that. But at the same time, what they went through has to be talked about. Otherwise, what's the point of it. But then after that, VEDA, well, fine, we're done with that. Now we can get on. And how long will it take to win the war in Japan is what it came down to. And so I went back to Oklahoma City and or NATTC and got a train, took another troop train, which is another great trip, to Narragansett Point, Rhode Island, where I went to my, was assigned to a unit. It actually became what they called a carrier aircraft service unit, is what it was. And that's what we did. We worked on carrier aircraft, armor, the guns is what we worked on. That's what I did. And then we started getting ready for the invasion in Japan, is all I can understand why is what we were doing. Otherwise, why else would they ship you to a small air base in the middle of Massachusetts, mark off an 800-foot spot of a landing strip, put some blue lights, not many, but some, and then make you practice night landings. I didn't fly. I was not a pilot, understand. But we are on duty, and we watch these guys do it. And it's a trick. It's a big trick, and there's something else to do that. Some of these pilots actually had experience aboard what they called the Jeep carriers in those days. The Jeep carrier actually helped win the war in the Atlantic. Jeep carrier was a small carrier deck built on a merchant ship. And the average merchant, I don't know how long they were, maybe 500, 400 feet, 500, something like that. And they flew anti-submarine patrols off those Jeep carriers. Now, when you think of a 10 to 15,000 ton ship, maybe 10 or smaller, it's a chip on the sea. I mean, it's small. It's small. But these guys flew these patrol missions off these Jeep carriers, and there were some of those Jeep carriers were stationed in Boston, not far from Narragansett, and elsewhere along the New England or the Atlantic coast, and the casualties were severe. Those landing of an aircraft, a patrol aircraft like the Avenger or one of those on a Jeep carrier was a trick. Not only a trick, you had better be damn good at doing it. But some of these pilots had experience in how to do it, and so they were given this additional training, as I understand it. I did not know this, but this is what they did. I did not know that they were former Jeep carrier pilots and all that sort of thing, but they did it. And anyhow, what else have you got?
Well, we'll kind of fast forward a little bit and go to from VE Day to VJ Day,
mm-hmm.
and your feelings there.
Well, VJ Day, I was assigned to be an MP, or not an MP, but a shore patrol. They needed a lot of folks in uniform on the streets to help keep and maintain order. And so I did. I got a stick and carried a 38, and I think it was a 38, Smith & Wesson, yeah, I think so, and an armband which said SP. And so we walked the streets of Providence, Rhode Island, because we were stationed at Narragansett then. And that was that. It was just a hectic time. Joy, you know, lots of noise, lots of celebration, lots of carrying ons and all that sort of thing. And it was over. It was over. No more of this is finally what even though we knew it was over earlier, because we were just going through the motions. We were flying some missions as training missions, but they were not, didn't mean anything. We were just waiting all to be discharged, because there was no need for us any longer. And we just kind of went through the motions. And I didn't do all that much, as I recall, because there wasn't all that much to do. Got some liberty from time to time, but I did get finally sent down to a small air base at Oceana, Virginia, to on a reassignment station there, and that's really where I finally got discharged from. I was discharged finally from Naval Air Station Oceana, Virginia, at Virginia Beach, and then I came home, and I hitchhiked home. They gave me my ruptured duck and my $200 and said goodbye, and that was that. And I went home. I hitchhiked in my uniform through Virginia, West Virginia, Ohio, Indiana. And finally I got home and said, "Hi, Mom, I'm home." And Dad said, "Congratulations, you're home." He took me downtown to Richmond Brothers in Sheboygan and bought me a new jacket and a pair of pants, and that was that. That's how I came home from the war.
Okay, we kind of talked about the atomic bomb.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, what were your feelings at that point? I mean, when they dropped the bomb and everyone essentially knew that the war was over at that point. I mean, was there a sense of relief?
Yeah. Accepting that we really didn't know what it meant. Because, and one thing I think still today, that they kept some of that from us for whatever reason. But the announcement was made that they had dropped an atomic bomb. Well, what the hell's an atomic bomb? We had no idea, other than the fact that it was a major weapon of incredible danger for a lot of people, because it killed a lot of people. But it was a bomb. An atom bomb, it was a bomb. It was dropped by an airplane. Bombs kill. Okay, bombs drop, bombs kill, it was a bomb. So, and that, what it meant to us was that apparently it had some kind of a decisive effect. What decisive effect? We had no idea what it meant. Retrospect again, though, later in my history, I learned, yes, it was the decisive weapon. And it was decisive for the Japanese. And it created a huge amount of division in this country as well, because of its huge effect and the huge number of casualties that it created and caused. And in retrospect, it probably was a turning point in our history, and should be, and should make us all realize that there's no point in anything that has to do with war. You can settle your differences in this country, in this world, if you want to, without going to war. You don't have to. War is medieval, is where it came from. Oh, sure, tribes fight and clash. But why must we be tribal? We say we're civilized. we say we don't, you know, the golden rule is, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And the Ten Commandments, you know, one of them, thou shalt not kill. All that's true. You don't need to go to war over anything. If people are willing to talk about those issues that divide, you can solve them. And one of the things I resent is the fact that our country has become less after World War II than what I thought it was ever going to become. I had hopes. But we didn't need to go to Vietnam. We may have, but it may have been necessary to go to Korea. But even that was not necessary in a sense. Communism was a red flag for a lot of people. We got to save the world from communism. That was pure bull. Communism wasn't any, it was never any threat to this country. If we believe in our democratic traditions, there's no threat that can beat us, because we're a democracy. We believe in figuring out what's wrong and adjusting and understanding what drives people and what people need. War never solves questions. It only creates more. You can go back into history's wars, and every one of them has created more problems than they solved. You want to talk about the revolution? Okay, that's an insurrection. It's a war of independence. What did it give us? Well, yes, it gave us independence. Would we have gotten independent from Britain without a war? Maybe. Maybe. The Civil War, was that an essential war? I guess you'd have to say in that case, maybe it was, because there, but the rebels, insurrectionists, were not ready to compromise on anything. And neither were the Northerners ready to compromise. But they could have. It could have been solved without a war. And as I said, World War I, the world's worst war, over nothing. Fought over absolutely nothing. I mean, the Germans and the British did not like each other. And the two royal houses of Britain and Germany, and with the French and the Russians and the Austrians and the Italians, all those people, fought over nothing. Yet it was the most, greater, more casualties in World War I than almost in World War II. And World War II itself could have been stopped early. The United States did not approve of of Woodrow Wilson's League of Nations. They defeated the chance to join the League of Nations. And why? Well, a couple of Republican senators said, we don't want this, and they fought Wilson's attempt to have the Senate ratify that treaty. In 1936, when Hitler reoccupied the Rhineland, Hitler told his generals that if the British and French move against you, retreat. Do not fight, but leave. Well, the British and French did not fight, did not even, they permitted it to happen. So the Germans said, okay, that settles it. We know what we can do. And they proceeded then to occupy Austria in 1938, the Sudetenland first, and then all of Austria, and then in 1939, war began against Poland, because Hitler knew that the Germans and the French, or British and the French, were not going to fight. But if the United States had been in the League of Nations at that time, I'm convinced, and other historians may disagree with me, and they probably will and should, but I'm convinced that if the American troops were there, Hitler would not have occupied the Rhineland and would not have become the force and power that he became after that issue, after that event. We don't solve anything by going to war, period. People have said this for centuries, that you don't have to fight. And yet, all the veterans today, they're talking about how wonderful it is that we are veterans. Well, yeah, it is. I'm proud of the fact that I was a veteran. But and they all say after their combat experiences, being shot up to hell on all these beaches and D-Day and whatnot, freedom is not free. Well, yeah, it's not free. But I am convinced that they hide behind that freedom is not free the fact that they don't understand how to go about extracting freedom from an issue that could be potentially fraught with, say, potential war. Why is it not possible for disagreements to be resolved in areas of discussion and diplomacy and the desire and, in fact, the need to talk to each other and find out really what it is that you need, that we have, that you want, and vice versa? I'm not a pacifist. I'm not. But I don't believe in war. But I went through it, and I know people who went through much more dangerous combat experiences than anybody I've ever met. One man, a friend of mine from when I lived in Minnesota, was a Ranger D-Day. He went ashore, by the way, not dropped. He didn't fly. He went ashore. Did he? He was assigned as a Ranger to go in advance at midnight, D-Day. And I really don't know what his assignment really was. But one day, one Memorial Day, I was watching on television an anniversary of D-Day. And he and his wife came over to play bridge and have dinner. And he saw what was on television, this anniversary of D-Day, and he said, "Turn that off." And when I turned it off, he said, "I can't stay here," and left. And to this day, I don't know what he went through, but it must have been holy hell, because he never even told his wife, and still hasn't, apparently. I think he's still living. But what he went through, no one ever really will ever know unless he talks to people like you, this wonderful thing you folks are doing. And I hope somewhere along the line he gets a chance to talk about this, because we really do need to remember what these they went through. I didn't go through it, what they went through. But we can't hide behind freedom is not free. That's such a easy shibboleth for us to remember, but it hides the true meaning of all of it. It really hides it. And I'm sorry that I have to say that, because I respect what these guys went through. And another friend of mine was in the 101st Airborne, D-Day. He took a stitch of machine gun bullets right across his belly. Imagine coming down in a parachute, and a German sees him coming down and shoots, and he's got half a dozen slugs across his belly. And it killed him. Actually, it eventually killed him. But he was an artist. One of the nicest guys I ever met in my whole life. Another guy, as I met, was aboard a B-17 and survived a crash, survived being shot down. And that was an experience. And the funny thing, in my later life, after I got out, I went to work in Chicago, and I went to, was going to school on there. And, I met, first of all, a guy, a young Japanese who served in the 442nd Infantry Battalion in Italy, and talk about shell shock. This guy was something else. He was just beyond, almost beyond anything. But he was working and trying to restore a sense of normalcy to his life. And he went through. He got the Silver Star. He got the Bronze Star. And I don't know how many oak leaf clusters and how many Purple Hearts and you name it. He got it. He did what he had to do. Another kid. At the same place we worked, he was a German soldier, but he was of Lithuanian descent, and he was drafted by the Germans, and he fought at Leningrad for the Germans. And in his broken English, he told me what it was like. And he went to hell. The Germans, the Russians, the Japanese soldiers all went to hell. Just like our soldiers did. Does anybody ever talk to them about what they went through? Do we know what happened to those people? We don't. But you can rest assured they went through the same things that we went through, or they went through. I didn't, but they did. And I admire them all. And I pity them all. Because what have they got? This morning, Armistice Day, we blow taps. You salute the flag, take off your hat, and there's these old veterans. One guy, one old sailor, a bosun's mate, first class, put on his World War II Navy enlisted man's dress blues, his stripes, his service stripe, his medals, all of it, in the uniform fit. And his white hat was snow white. That was one thing we had to do. We had to scrub that hat to make it snow white. And an inspection every Saturday morning, if it wasn't white, we got holy hell, believe it or not. It was crazy. But this guy's hat was snow white, and his uniform was crisp, and it fit. And I walked up to him, and I said, "That son of a bitch still fits, doesn't it?" And he looked at me, and he said, "Did you have one of them goddamn things, too?" I said, "Yes, I did." He shook my hand, and we talked. He's on oxygen, and he's 84. He went through a lot of it. He was on destroyers and cruiser, on a cruiser, and he finally was assigned to the Iowa or Wisconsin, but he went through all of it. And I think